But now on BBC Radio 4, John Burt ransacks the P.G. Wodehouse notebooks for some unpublished early jottings of the great writer, which are read by Tim McInerney.
We all act through life, and each of us selects the special audience he wishes to impress. When this audience is not looking at us, we are never really happy, however many other people are applauding.
This is P.G. Wodehouse at the very beginning of his life as a writer. He's living in digs in Chelsea, working in a bank, but filling every spare hour of every day by writing in pen and ink in a good quality lined notebook, which is now happily preserved in the Wodehouse archive, as tangible evidence of a young writer's promise.
The young author always writes, as it were, with a nervous laugh, like a shy young man saying a good thing in the company of strangers.
The Wodehouse notebooks, actually there are three of them, crammed full of miscellaneous ideas, jokes and stories, were bought for the archive in the 1980s. The date on the first notebook is May 1900, so Wodehouse would have been just 19. Robert McCrum is writing a new biography of the author and has built up an image of this young man, fresh from public school.
He was a big man, 6'2", 6'3". He kept his same weight most of his life. He had a roundish, boyish face. A lot of people who saw him at that time describe him as a, quote, boy. So there's a boy side to him. And he's quite shy, he's quite diffident, especially with girls, but he's very sweet. He has a kind of sweet innocence about him, which is apparently very appealing. And I see him in a stiff white collar, tie, suit, lace-up boots, and probably a hat. Almost certainly a hat, a bowler hat, or a soft hat of some kind.
He would have preferred to go to Oxford after six happy years at Dulwich College. However, family circumstances made this unaffordable. His father had recently retired from being a magistrate in Hong Kong. Actually, he got very bad sunstroke while trying to walk round the island for a bet. Rather a Wodehousian touch, that. So he came back to England with a pension, which was paid in rupees. There was a run on the rupee in 1900, and consequently young Pelham Grenville, better known in the family as Plum, had to go out to work. His father engineered a job for him in the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank in Lombard Street. At the end of each working day, the trainee banker recorded his observations in the notebook.
At lunchtime, Harris goes into the National Bank without a hat on. The bald cashier, wearing a wig, says, "Why don't you HSBC men wear hats like gentlemen?" "Oh," says Harris, "we have a natural head covering." When he got back to his desk, Billy said to him, "I want to see Mrs. Hawkins' account." Harris replied, "You'd better ask that gentleman there. He's on the A to B ledger. I'm doing F to H." Later, I overheard Charles the messenger saying to a customer who'd come in to complain of something, "Oh, you see, sir, but this ain't a regular bank. It's just a place where they prepares young gentlemen for the East."
Plum admitted later that during his 2 years in the bank, he never had the slightest inkling of how banking actually worked. He started in the post room, then graduated to fixed deposits and later inward bills. At least his daily chores continued to provide fuel for a writer's imagination.
Idea for Punch, maybe? The bank opera. Hero's song.
She wore a coat of novel style. Her eyes were azure stars. And with a soft, bewitching smile, she spoke to me through the bars. Ah, yes, she spoke to me, and oh, I felt I'd perish for her. But duty made me answer no. Effects refer to draw. To duty's call he bowed, and so referred her to the draw.
There's a plaque today in Lombard Street to commemorate the time that Plum spent at the HSBC. Sir Edward Cazalet is Wodehouse's step-grandson. He recognises the crucial part the bank played in the writer's development.
He had quite an active sporting life in the bank, because in those days the bank had a cricket side, it had a rugby side, and he did say that there was a camaraderie in the bank which sort of kept them all going, even though they might not wholly enjoy what they were doing. He proved to be the most inefficient clerk whose trouser seat had ever polished the leather of a high stool in any bank. And also it kept him out of what I think might have been an academic career, and if he'd started an academic career by going up to Oxford and onwards, it could be that he wouldn't have started writing to a much later stage, and indeed might have written in a somewhat different vein.
A bank's day ends gradually, reluctantly, as it were. At about five, there is a sort of stir, not unlike the stir in a theatre when the curtain is on the point of falling. Ledgers are closed with a bang. Men stand about and talk for a moment or two before going to the basement for their hats and coats. There is an air of relaxation about the place, though some departments are still working as hard as ever under a blaze of electric light. Somebody begins to sing, and an instant chorus of protests and maledictions rises from all sides. Gradually, however, the electric lights go out. The procession down the centre aisle becomes more regular, and eventually the place is left to darkness and the night watchman.
After work, Woodhouse would walk back to his digs in Chelsea. Norman Murphy has spent many years researching Woodhouse locations and connections in his life and in his fiction. Murphy has located the house in Chelsea where this young author had the top floor.
It was cheap, it was digs, and he shared a room or rooms there with Percival Graves, Robert Graves' eldest brother. And he remembers Woodhouse, after supper every night, going upstairs and occupying the loo for 3 hours while he wrote. He didn't want company, he wanted to write. He was writing for his life.
He was also learning to play the banjolele. A clue, perhaps, to the inspiration behind this musical awakening turns up later on in Thank You, Jeeves.
Those who know Bertram Wooster are aware that he is a man of sudden, strong enthusiasms and that, when in the grip of one of these, he becomes a remorseless machine, tense, absorbed, single-minded. It was so in the matter of this banjolele playing. Since the night at the Alhambra, when the supreme virtuosity of Ben Bloom and his 16 Baltimore buddies had fired him to take up the study of the instrument, not a day had passed without its couple of hours of assiduous practice.
Plum's instrumental experience would come in handy in later years when he was writing lyrics for musical comedies with Jerome Kern and Ivan Novello. He greatly admired Gilbert and Sullivan and was becoming hooked on the atmosphere of the theatre.
Behind the scenes at Chelsea Palace Music Hall, there are lanes of cloth stretching to ceiling, ending in brightly lit stage. Bare, whitewashed walls with hot water pipes and fire hose and red buckets. Above the stage, rows of electric lights in coloured glasses with wires over them. There's a tattered notice on the wall relating to the Music Hall Benevolent Fund. Some pros appeal to the profession, stating how reluctantly he had taken charge of the thing. Of course, from the age of 12, the music hall appealed to the artist in me. I have always had the sort of mentality which the music hall satisfied. It took strong men to drag me to see Herbert Beerbohm Tree and Julius Caesar, but if Dan Leno was on in Islington, I was there in two jumps. In fact, it was my earliest ambition to become a comedian on the halls. It was because a music hall comedian required vim, pep, a good singing voice, and a sort of indefinable je ne sais quoi, none of which qualities I appeared to possess, that I abandoned my ambitions and became a writer.
His life is pretty dull, I think, at this time. I mean, he's working very hard. He plays cricket a lot when he can. He's part of a kind of indigent circle of struggling artists, and he goes out for dinners in Soho. You know, four courses and coffee will cost 2 and 6. And I think the other thing he does for recreation is he walks. He's a very keen walker, and he walks about making observations of what he sees around him, conversations that he overhears, conversations he has with people in the street, and so forth.
A shabby man stops me in Cromwell Road and asks for a lift. Says he is 56 and was once at Bedford Grammar School. I little thought when I sang that old chant, Concinamus o Sodales, that I would come to this. I lost my wife. She's buried in Kensal Green. I spent my Christmas sitting on Barnes Common like a fool and crying like a baby. I was in the city and the firm went to smash. That was 16 months ago. And now I'm wandering through the streets entirely sine pecunia. I gave him a shilling, all I had on me, and wished him luck. Note the interlarding of Latin phrases, and also the fact that, like a pleasant fellow, he retained his pipe in his poverty. He had an honest, humorous eye and a cheerful expression.
I think the notebooks are very interesting because they show how his mind works. He's not terribly interested in current affairs, big politics, although he's perfectly well aware of them, actually. They don't concern him. He's concerned with the minutiae, the details. the texture of everyday life, what it costs to take a cab, what somebody says on the bus, what the down and out says. He is somebody who has got a very sharp eye and a very sharp ear for everyday life.
In the Strand, I heard a cabman saying to a cyclist whom he has knocked down, "Ah, now, if you'd taken a cab, this here wouldn't have happened." Margie Waldron is always having rows with cabmen because she is so tender-hearted concerning their horses. Once she opened the trap door and said solemnly, "I object to your beating that horse," which squashed the cabbie completely. Only Aunt Jew spoiled the effect by roaring with laughter. Margie says, "If you ever want a free ride, hunt about bottom of cab with match at end of ride, and then go indoors, saying you've lost £1 in cab and are going for more matches, telling cabbie to wait. When you come back, cab will have departed." Bill Townend told me once that he saw a cab collide with a broom coming back from Dan Leno's funeral. A refined, demure-looking lady stuck her head out of the window of the cab and said, "Hello, hello, hello. Now then, now then, now then. Who are you shoving?"
"You're desperate for ideas, and you need notebooks to give them ideas. And some of the incidents he recorded he didn't use for 10 years. He had a social life at weekends. He had relations all over London, these Victorian aunts, who made sure he had a decent meal or whatever it was, or kept an eye on him and made sure he was properly dressed. Morning calls, he'd be expected to pay those in his frock coat and his top hat, borrowed from his uncle and his father and his spats, because otherwise, you know, they'd write to his parents, say, he'd let himself go."
One of the things that he recalled was how when he was starting, let's say, learning his trade, he recounted how in his room in Markham Square, he had one stage, 131 rejection slips plastered up on the wall, and he took these with an element of humour. Painful that must have been. The fact was that he regarded it as he said, part of the process of learning his trade, and he learnt what sold, and then he developed that.
A typical conversation between editor and writer. Editor: "You will be paid for your contribution in good time." Writer, 3 months later: "Is the good time coming?"
Well, we know what his breakthrough was because he kept from the beginning a book he called, and I'm reading from the title page, "Money Receive for Literary Work" by P.G. Woodhouse, to which he appends a motto from his favourite writer, W.S. Gilbert, a quotation from Iolanthe: "Though never nurtured in the lap of luxury, yet I admonish you. I am an intellectual chap and think of things which would astonish you." And the first entry is dated February 1900, he says, 1:10-6 for a prize contribution to the Public School Magazine, then under the editorship of P.W. Wilson, afterwards editor of Fun, subject, "Some Aspects of Game Captaincy," paid April 9th, 1900, and that's his first contribution. So there he is, he's writing about sport, his favourite subject, the Public School Magazine, for an audience he understood, the public schoolboys.
Conan Doyle once said to me, "If you can write so as to please schoolboys, you will do well. There is no better critic within his limits than the schoolboy."
School was an inspiration and a happy memory for Woodhouse all his life. In early childhood, while his parents were in Hong Kong, he and his brothers were brought up in England by various aunts and dames. He didn't see his mother for 4 years. But Dulwich College gave him 6 years of order, structure and friendship. The family he never knew.
Remember when Sneap and Brush came in after the Borders versus Dayboys match, played in dense fog, and found just one bit of bread and butter left in senior study? They proceeded to wrestle for it, Brush holding a cup of tea in one hand. The tea spilled over Drysdale's shirt. Dee, meanwhile, was having a bath upstairs. Might begin a school story with this. After tea at Treadgold's, the popular pastime was always ping-pong, played on the table of the senior study across a barrier of books. The books act as bats, and a fives ball is used. Langdon says that he always finds a Greek book makes a better bat than a Latin one. The rest of the prefects and whoever is stopping in sit around and read and look on. Nobody dreams of doing any work for at least an hour after tea. Also for school stories: in the classics form room, there is an iron pillar supporting the roof. Formmaster leaves the room and two chaps swarm up it. One gets down, but the other is caught and is asked why he is up there. "Please, sir," he says, "I dropped my pencil."
He was a very successful schoolboy. He was in all the school sides. He was a fine athlete. He edited the school magazine, and he was obviously very popular. And he simply loved his time there. A lot of notes about little incidents at school and so forth, and particularly about Jukes, the great headmaster of his day. Plum used to say that Jukes used to stand 6'6" in his socks with a long grey beard and used to scare the pants out of him. Actually, in these notes, he adopts a rather different approach to Jukes. I see that he says that Jukes is an extremely kindly man.
School stories could write one round a headmaster like Jukes, who tries to rule by kindness. When he catches anybody breaking rules very flagrantly, he makes him a school prefect. The chap, thus getting more liberty, thinks the old man a fool and becomes worse than ever. Also on Jukes, he doesn't understand the moral blindness and callousness of boys. Thus he thinks that by apologising to a boy, he will touch his heart and make him repent and turn over a new leaf. Not a bit of it. Boys respect strength, nothing but strength. They may dislike it, but they respect it. A school is like a child. The mother who alternately spoils and storms at her child makes it unmanageable. Same with a headmaster and a school.
Dulwich was his real home. For the first time in life, regular routine, regular friends, same routine day in, day out. He visited there, as we know from his notebooks now, frequently afterwards, looking for stories, catching up with things, worrying about the school. The notebooks also show he got ideas from elsewhere. Malcolm Thompson, he's the man to keep an eye on. Malcolm Thompson was a cousin of Woodhouse's on his mother's side, and Thompson went to Winchester. And Malcolm Thompson gave Woodhouse 2 pages in the notebooks of stories. Every anecdote there is used somewhere.
Some of Malcolm's Winchester adventures to be put into school stories. He told me that he got 12 hidings during his first half, with ground ash and fives bat. Once, for not lubricating his fagmaster's footer boots properly, he received 6 running kicks from fagmaster wearing said boots. Could make a villain do this in a story and hero interfere. His fagmaster was not a bad chap, though very brutal to Malcolm at first. He was also captain of footer, fives and cricket, and was sacked 2 days before Lord's match. This nearly caused a revolution in the school. 2 other notes. 1. Fags, however much licked, did not bear ill will. They took it all in day's work and got very tough. 2. Bullies are hardly ever cowards.
The comic writer that we celebrate today is not really evident in these notebooks, other than that he does have an eye for quirky conversations and he has a wonderful ear for the way people speak, which is carried on all the way through the Jeeves and Wooster stories. But what he was at this point was more a kind of would-be social realist in some ways, or a would-be satirist. And you see glimpses of that in all the early books. Quite precise, in fact, very precise pictures of life below stairs, life at a football match. And actually, his account of school, public school, is very accurate and sparkling, but not funny.
There are some notes which demonstrate his fascination with what you might call relationships below stairs. And he did say in later life that when he'd gone as a boy to rather grand houses taken by his, perhaps some aunts he was staying with, he found himself very much enjoying being, as it were, with the butler and so forth, and he got on much better there and felt much more at ease, and so he was allowed to do that, and that of itself, no doubt, gave him the ability to appreciate how life was led by all of them.
In the Dean household, there are 11 servants, a butler, 2 footmen, Lady Dean's maid, Mrs. Scott's sort of nurse, a housekeeper, a head housemaid, 2 housemaids, a cook and a scullery maid. The butler, cook, housekeeper and head housemaid mess together. The others have another mess. Strict etiquette is observed. Everyone is Mr. X and Miss Y. The cook is always called Mrs., whether she is married or not. The butler is the captain of the view. He keeps them up to their work. When things go wrong, Lady D rags the butler, and he rags whoever's done it.
The Deans were cousins of Woodhouse on his mother's side. His Aunt Louisa was his favourite aunt, who later would become the blueprint for Bertie Wooster's kind-hearted Aunt Dahlia, while his Aunt Mary would also manifest herself in fiction as the fearsome Aunt Agatha. And it was while staying with the Deans in Lyme Regis that Woodhouse got to know 3 schoolgirls, who also figure largely in this writer's notebooks.
Some notes on Joan, Effie and Teeny, age now 14, 13 and 11. Effie says she would marry a rich man, however much of a beast he was, simply to get a horse. At tea in Lyme Regis, Joan gave me a bun with raspberry jam on it and said, "The raspberry jam doesn't go right through." "Ah, my child," I said, "in all the affairs of life, you will find that the raspberry jam never goes right through." Mrs. Lyon made Teeny cry by telling her that she had not grown enough during the past year. Fortunately, at dinner, without being prompted in any way, I tell Teeny that she is the perfect woman and just the right height. Teenie tells me that she has £25 in the bank, and when she comes of age, she's going to buy a hat.
These three precocious sisters were granddaughters of the Earl of Strathmore and junior members of the aristocratic Bowes Lyon family.
Hubert Lyon says that for 500 years, not a single lion has ever done anything. They have simply been born, become Earl of Strathmore, and died. They go into the army and marry as lieutenants. Marriage always ruins their career. They do nothing after it. I might make this the motive of a novel or play. Girl in love with a man refuses to marry him until he has achieved something in his life.
Woodhouse became a family friend of the Lyons and was often invited to tea at their London home, 22 Ovington Crescent.
I told Mrs. Lyon today that I occupy in her house a position equivalent to that of the cold beef at lunch. If there is nothing more exciting, the cold beef is welcomed. If there is nobody new to talk to, the Lyon cubs talk to me.
We don't know much about these three girls. They appear to have been sufficiently young for him to have felt unthreatened by them sexually and emotionally. I have a strong sense of him being pretty awkward with girls, even at this age. But these girls, he is at ease with, he chats to them, because they're pre-sexual, so they aren't a threat to him. And he's just chatting to them, and he's writing down what they say.
Could work up a comic railway scene from Effie's adventures on her way to Bridgenorth. Her fellow passengers were Auntie, enormously stout in skin-tight grey alpaca, Albert, the rudest boy on earth, aged about 14, and a niece, about 20. They ate the whole way, 9 a.m. to 12 a.m, starting with something awful that smelt of aniseed, then meat sandwiches, then sausage rolls, then milk for Albert and jam puffs, then hunks of bread and cheese. Auntie sits heavily on Albert's bag of food and is rebuked by him. She is very energetic, skims down the platform for the cup of teas, leaves one on the counter, being in a flurry, gets the wrong change, and comes back just as the train is moving off. If Auntie do come back, says niece with obvious enjoyment, she won't be able to get in.
Those three little girls, of course, also play an important part in Woodhouse's career, because those three little girls, he asked, they can remember, because one of them told me, him saying, should he leave the bank to become a writer? And he all said, yes, he should. So perhaps we owe those three little girls quite a big debt. First book he wrote, The Pot Hunters, dedicated to Joan, Effie and Ernestine Bowes Lyon.
In fact, when I first saw that many years ago, it struck me that Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, might know something about that. And knowing that she was an ardent Woodhouse fan, I wrote to her and asked her if, in fact, these were members of her family. And she said, yes, indeed they were. She referred to them as a group as my naughty cousins, and she'd known them, and they'd had quite a lot of fun together. So it's a lovely connection, and she was very well informed on the Woodhouse works generally.
His wife once said, Plummy lives in the moon, which is her way of saying that he lives entirely in the world of his imagination. I think what the notebooks show is that he's somebody who is completely absorbed in his own view of the world, and he is concerned really only in how it affects his picture of things. And all his life, he doesn't really leave the world that's in his head, and he adds to it. But, for example, during the Second World War, when he's interned in a pretty grisly camp in Poland, you might expect that the experience of being interned would have crept in some small way into his fiction, because he writes a novel while he's in camp. But you can go through Money in the Bank, which is written in camp, and you can't find a single reference, any kind, even an allusion to deprivation, privation, hunger, hardship of any kind, certainly not warfare. And that's not just that he's autistic or anything, it's simply that he is completely absorbed in his imaginative landscape. And the notebooks reflect that. They reflect somebody who is putting flesh and bones on a world which is in his mind.
Idea for a fable, possibly for Punch. Man in love with a girl. He calls at her bijou residence and asks her very politely what he should do to make himself worthy of her. And she says that what she most admires is personal beauty. So he thanks her and goes away and buys cosmetics and things, etc. After a month's treatment, he comes back and in a glowing passage invites her to name the happy day. Nay, says the damsel, but on second thoughts I have changed my mind. What I really dote on is brains. So he goes away, etc., etc. But then she again changes her mind and says she wants strength. And then finally votes for a sort of general je ne sais quoi. And he goes away disgusted and marries her sister Jane. Moral. second thoughts are not always the best.
In September 1902, he chucked the bank and took his chances as a freelance writer. By the end of that first year, he had earned £65, 6 shillings and 7 pence.
It's a funny thing about writing. If you're a writer by nature, I don't believe you write for money or fame or even for publication, but simply for the pleasure of turning out the stuff. What makes a writer write is that he likes writing. Naturally, when he has written something, he wants to get as much for it as he can, but that is a different thing from writing for money.
And this money-received literary work runs from 1900 to 1908, February 1908. And it's an absolutely faithful record of his earnings during this period, and you really can see what he's up to. It's very typical of him that there are no personal revelations, there are no intimacies or asides. There's just a very routine cataloguing of his earnings from The Captain, The Strand magazine, Books of Today, Pearson's, Munsey's, The Globe, Vanity Fair, and so on. And here we are in May 1904, it says, in New York, gathering experience, full stop, worth many guineas in the future but none for the moment, which is absolutely true, because in the end he becomes in many ways more American than English after about 1915.
Of course, when asked his income, a man under 25 will always understate it, while a chap over 25 will overstate it. The reason for this is that the man of 25 is younger than the average man, and the average man dislikes a man to be both richer and younger than himself, and also he suspects a young and rich man of being self-satisfied and without ambition. And, of course, a young man without ambition is an awful being.
You also see here we are, total for June, £25, 8 shillings. Total for July, £24, 3 and 6. And at the end of the year, he'll say, total for 1904, £411, 14 shillings and 10 pence. That's a pretty good income. He's doing fine. Actually, on this day, he does have a little personal note. He says, on this day, the 13th of December, 1904, time, midnight, I set it down that I have arrived. And then he describes the work he's doing. But he has arrived, he's there, he's established, he's making a good living. He's making enough money, in fact, that he's able to buy a car, which in those days was remarkable.
In my early 20s, it would not be too much to say that I was the talk of London. If you had not seen me riding my bicycle down the Strand to the offices of the Globe, frequently using no hands and sometimes bending over to pick up a handkerchief with my teeth, it was pretty generally agreed that he had not seen anything. And the public's memory must be very short if the 22 not out I made for the Globe against the printers of the Evening Standard one Sunday in 1904 has already been forgotten. I was leaving footprints on the sands of time, and good large footprints at that.
The Woodhouse Notebooks was an independent production for BBC Radio 4 by Tony Staveacre. The banjo was played by Julian Vincent.